The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards, and this is the North Carolina Reading Service with Armchair Traveler, and for the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the National Geographic. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, I want to remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles that we're going to be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. Today on Armchair Traveler, we explore one of the world's greatest mysteries. Stonehenge Revealed is the cover story for the August 2022 issue of National Geographic. As the editors write, it's not just Stonehenge. New discoveries reveal an era when awe-inspiring monuments were all the rage. Interim Editor-in-Chief David Brindley is going to provide some background with his commentary, Stonehenge as You've Never Seen It. And he writes, "The prehistoric cluster of standing stones known as Stonehenge has intrigued and mystified observers for centuries. The impressive monument has drawn millions of visitors to England's Salisbury Plain. Throughout our publishing history, National Geographic has brought images and stories of Stonehenge to readers in new and exciting ways. The magazine's very first picture of the megalith is the black-and-white aerial photo that's shown in this article. Published in May 1922, it was made possible by the cutting-edge technology of that era, the airplane. For this issue's cover story, we deployed the latest tools to bring you Stonehenge as you've never seen it. We assigned two inventive photographers, Alice Zhu, documented people's connections to Neolithic sites, and Ruben Wu, turned landscapes into otherworldly realms steeped in mystery. Then we decided to go further, to create an immersive high-resolution 3D model of the site using photogrammetry. Now, we enlisted National Geographic explorer and photographer Martin Edstrom. He and his team flew a drone to make more than 7,000 images of the site from all angles and process them into the digital replica that is shown here at the top of the page. And it's a circle, and it's almost got a 3D look to it here in the magazine, even though it's on a page. It's got a green surface that these stones sit on, and the various stones are in a circular fashion. And you can tell there's been some wear and tear, maybe even some damage and disrepair among the monuments. But nonetheless, you get the idea. Anyway, and so here he has this replica, as we see. And then David Brindley continues with, "We've been pushing the boundaries of storytelling for 134 years, and I'm pleased to share our latest work with you." And he writes that you can go to at Nat Geo, that's an Instagram address, at Nat Geo, N-A-T-G-E-O, on Instagram, to explore this immersive model of Stonehenge, and visit ngm.com, that's ngm.com, to see more images and video of the site. So there you go. So National Geographic offering you an opportunity to delve even more into what we call Stonehenge, okay? Well, let's talk now about writer Rolf Smith and his article, which focuses on the building boom associated with Stonehenge. Now, Smith lives on the south coast of England, and he's very familiar with its history and the many stories surrounding Stonehenge, so let's learn more. Something momentous was in the air in the south of Britain about 4,500 years ago, during the dying days of the Neolithic era, the final chapter of the Stone Age. Whatever it was, religious zeal, bravura, a sense of impending change, it cast a spell over the inhabitants and stirred them into a frenzy of monument building. In an astonishingly brief span of time, perhaps as little as a century, people who lacked metal tools, horsepower, and the wheel erected many of Britain's huge stone circles, colossal wooden palisades, and grand avenues of standing stones. In the process, they robbed forests of their biggest trees and moved millions of tons of earth. It was like a mania sweeping the countryside, an obsession that drove them to build bigger and bigger, more and more, better and more complex, says Susan Greeney, an archaeologist with the nonprofit English Heritage. The most famous relic of that long-ago building boom is Stonehenge, the huddle of standing stones that draws millions of visitors to England's Salisbury Plain. For centuries, the ancient megalith has intrigued and mystified all who've seen it, including the medieval historian Henry of Huntingdon. Writing around 1130, the first known references to Stonehenge in print, he declared it to be one of the wonders of England, adding that no one knew how it was built or why. In the 900 years since, the solar-aligned stone ring has been attributed to Romans, Druids, Vikings, Saxons, and even King Arthur's court magician, Merlin. Yet the truth is the most inscrutable of all, for it was built by a vanished people who left no written language, no tales or legends, only a scatter of bones, potsherds, stone and antler tools, and an array of equally mysterious monuments, some of which appear to have eclipsed Stonehenge in scale and grandeur. One of the most stunning structures, known today as the Mount Pleasant Megahenge, was built on a grassy upland overlooking the rivers Frome and Winterbourne. An army of workers used antler picks and cowbone shovels to dig an enormous ring-shaped ditch, an embankment or henge, three-quarters of a mile in circumference, more than three times larger than Stonehenge's ditch and bank. Inside the great earthwork, the builders reared a circle of towering timber posts from oak trees, some 6 feet thick and weighing more than 17 tons. "We're all familiar with Stonehenge," Greeny says. "After all, it's built of stone, and it survived. But what were these huge timber structures like?" These things were absolutely massive and would have dominated the landscape for centuries. Antiquarians and archaeologists have been picking over England's ancient henges, mounds, and stone circles since the 17th century. Yet it wasn't until recent years that anyone realized many of these mega monuments had been built at roughly the same time and in a mad rush. It was always assumed these huge monuments had evolved separately and over many centuries, Greeny says. Now a burst of cutting-edge technologies has thrown open new windows into the past, allowing archaeologists to piece together the world of the Stone Age monuments of southern Britain and the people who built them, with a vividness that would have been more inconceivable a few decades ago. "It's almost like starting over from scratch," says Jim Leary, a lecturer in field archaeology at the University of York. "A lot of the things we were taught as undergraduates in the 1990s we know now simply aren't true. One of the most startling shakeups has been the discovery through DNA evidence of a mass migration from the European continent that took place around 4000 BC. The wave of newcomers whose ancestry stretched back thousands of years to Anatolia, which is modern Turkey, replaced Britain's indigenous hunter-gatherers with a genetically distinct people who cultivated cereal crops and raised livestock. Nobody believed it could happen that way," Leary says. "The idea of the agricultural revolution arriving in Britain because of a wholesale migration of people seemed too simplistic. Everyone was looking for a more nuanced narrative, a diffusion of ideas, not just masses of people getting on boats. But it turns out it really was that simple. Some of the migrants made the short hop at the narrowest point of the English Channel, crossing what is now the Strait of Dover. Others from Brittany and western France made longer, more dangerous open-water crossings to western Britain and Ireland. Some of these earliest Breton pioneers settled along the rugged coast of Pembrokeshire in Wales. It may have been their descendants, some 40 generations later, who built the first edition of Stonehenge." Archaeologists know to look to Wales for the start of the story, primarily because of a sharp-eyed geologist named Herbert Thomas. Think of Stonehenge, and you'll almost certainly envision its huge Saracen trilithons. But another much smaller type of monolith huddles within the horseshoe of trilithons, the bluestones. Unlike the Saracens, which are made of local silica-rich stone, the bluestones are entirely alien to the landscape. There are no rock types like them anywhere near Stonehenge. Bluestone monoliths weigh an average of 2 tons each. Where they came from and how they came to be arranged in a ring in the middle of Salisbury Plain was already a centuries-old mystery when Thomas was shown a sampling of them in 1923. Among the pieces was a type of bluestone called spotted dolerite, and he recalled seeing outcrops of the same rock many years earlier while hiking in the Presley Hills, a wild moorland in Pembrokeshire, some 175 miles from Stonehenge. After further examination, Thomas narrowed down the source of the bluestone to rocky outcrops called Carnmeany. In recent years, Richard Bevins, a geologist with the National Museum of Wales, and fellow geologist Rob Ixer from the University of College of London's Institute of Archaeology, have been revisiting Thomas's work using 21st century technologies with flashy names such as X-ray fluorescence spectrometry and ICP-MS laser ablation. The pair have identified four outcrops in the Presley Hills that contributed bluestone monoliths to Stonehenge. Turns out Thomas was off the mark by only a mile or two. For archaeologists hunting clues to the Stonehenge story, it's a fresh start, one made all the more tantalizing by a breakthrough in biochemistry. A Belgian researcher named Christophe Schneck pioneered a technique to retrieve isotopes from cremated remains that reveal where an individual lived during the last decade of life. He analyzed the bones of 25 people whose cremated remains had been buried at Stonehenge in the early days, when the bluestones were erected, and found that nearly half of them had lived miles from Stonehenge. When paired with archaeological evidence, North Devon and southwestern Wales are likely possibilities. Incredibly, he was even able to pick up carbon and oxygen isotope signatures from the smoke of the funeral pyres that had consumed the bodies. These opened yet another window into the past, indicating that in some of the cremations, the trees that had supplied the wood for the fire may have grown in dense, canopied forest, not lightly wooded landscape around Stonehenge. We can't say for certain that the people buried at Stonehenge came from southwestern Wales, says Oxford University archaeology professor Rick Schulting. But archaeology is like building a court case. You look at the preponderance of evidence. The fact that we know the bluestones definitely came from the Presley Hills in Wales means that's a good place to start looking. It's a chilly dawn in mid-September, and a dense mist has closed in around Wan Mon, the site of four remaining ancient stones in the Presley Hills. The dramatic coastline here, in many miles and a world away from the windswept plain where Stonehenge stands today. The mist has turned archaeologist and National Geographic explorer Mike Parker Pearson, and his team into ghostly silhouettes with picks and shovels and wheelbarrows. Parker Pearson, an expert in British prehistory at University College London's Institute of Archaeology, has come to this desolate spot to investigate the possibility, first suggested in a 12th century legend that the standing stones at Stonehenge may have come from an earlier stone circle in a faraway land. The medieval chronicler and cleric Geoffrey of Monmouth wrote a rollicking tale of how Stonehenge's monoliths were taken from a stone circle in Ireland after a great battle and transported by magic and by boat to where they stand today. While the story is fanciful, there's a chance it may have been based on an old oral tradition that had a kernel of truth to it, says Parker Pearson. For one thing, the stones at Stonehenge actually were transported. Of the hundreds of stone circles in Britain, Stonehenge is the only one whose stones were brought from a great distance. Every other one is made of local stone. It's something that could not have been known in Geoffrey's day. What's more, he points out, this region of Wales was considered Irish territory at the time. Geoffrey was writing. Indeed, from this hilltop on a clear day, you can glimpse the Irish coast in the distance. And there's Wan Mon itself, the remains of one of the earliest stone circles in Britain, dating to around 3300 B.C., and located within a few miles of the outcrops where the Stonehenge bluestones are now known to have originated. For some reason, they started building it and abandoned it after they got about a third of the way through, Parker Pearson says, of Wan Mon. We can see where they actually dug holes for additional stones, but never placed them. Of the 15 or so stones that were installed, only one remained standing. Three more are lying in the grass. The rest are missing. Last year, Parker Pearson and his colleagues published a theory that the Stonehenge we know today was built in whole or in part from stones from earlier monuments in Wales that were dismantled and carried east by a migrating community around 3000 B.C. One stone in particular, number 62 in the nomenclature of Stonehenge archaeologists, could possibly be traced directly to Wan Mon. The claim, which aired on a British TV special, created a stir in the press and divided archaeologists. Some were skeptical that Wan Mon was a stone circle at all, but merely a few isolated stones, and so Parker Pearson returned to Wan Mon to firm up his theory. The evidence is certainly tantalizing. Stone 62 is one of only three bluestones at Stonehenge made of non-spotted dolerite, the type of stone used to build Wan Mon. Moreover, Stone 62 has a peculiar pentagonal cross-section, that appears to match the imprint left by one of the stones that were removed from the ancient Welsh circle. In addition, a stone chip found in the former socket hole suggested that the missing stone was also a non-spotted dolerite. During their follow-up excavation, Parker Pearson and his team were able to build on evidence that Wan Mon was indeed a stone circle and one of strikingly similar dimensions to the early ditch that ringed Stonehenge. And like Stonehenge, Wan Mon appears to have been aligned with the solstice, but they were unable to establish a definitive geochemical match between anything at Wan Mon and the bluestones at Stonehenge, which might have proved their case. But finding an exact match with any one stone was always going to be a long shot. Parker Pearson says, noting that of the 80-some bluestones archaeologists believe once stood at Stonehenge, only 43% are present today. "We have missing stones there and missing stones here," he says, "but what we've got now is a good evidence that people who were building the circle in Wan Mon stopped in the middle of making it. They dig a hole for the next stone and then don't fill it. What happened? Where did they go? And where are the stones?" Archaeological evidence, or the lack of it, suggests that few people were living at Wan Mon after 3000 BC, a date that dovetails nicely with the idea of a migration from Wales. "But an absence of evidence isn't evidence of absence," says Parker Pearson, who hopes to return to the Presley Hills to study ancient pollens that could reveal whether the grazing lands reverted to wilderness around that time. If so, the finding could add weight to the theory that the area was abandoned about the time Stonehenge was built. And if Stonehenge's curiously shaped Stone 62 can't be conclusively linked with the stone circle in the Presley Hills, research by geologists Bevins and Ixer has pinpointed the outcrop from which it came a little to the east of Wan Mon. "It's an outcrop that no archaeologist has looked at yet," Bevins says. "As geologists, we can't tell the human side of the story, but we can certainly give them a fresh place to pick up the trail." It's about a four-hour drive from Wan Mon to Stonehenge, the last few miles of which are along the A303. This narrow, potholed, notoriously traffic-choked highway passes so close to Stonehenge, the famous monument is almost a roadside attraction. If the intention of the original builders of Stonehenge was to create a landmark that could capture the imaginations of generations to come, they succeeded beyond their wildest dreams. The global icon is one of Britain's biggest tourist draws, attracting more than 1 million visitors a year before the COVID-19 epidemic. Virtually all of them here on the A303, which is also a major truck artery, and the road taken by millions of vacationers to popular seaside resort towns. In recent decades, A303 has been upgraded to a four-lane highway for much of its length, but not the few miles either side of Stonehenge. Constant traffic jams mean that it can take locals an hour to drive from one nearby village to another, while endless rumbling trucks detract from the experience of visiting Stonehenge. "Everybody agrees that something needs to be done about the A303, says Vince Gaffney, professor of landscape archaeology at the University of Bradford. "The question is, what? Stonehenge is the centerpiece of a 20-square-mile UNESCO World Heritage Site, which in turn abuts areas of environmentally sensitive land, a military base and proving ground, and many small communities. So there are few uncontested options for rerouting the highway. A controversial proposal to build a 2-mile-long four-lane tunnel to bypass Stonehenge site drew fire from archaeologists and sparked protests from a coalition of environmentalists and druids. Last year, Britain's High Court found in favor of the protesters and put the $2.2 billion project on hold. Ironically, the surprise discovery of a mile-wide ring of enormous pits around the nearby henge at Durrington Walls, dug by Neolithic excavators about 4,400 years ago, near the peak of the building boom, played a role in thwarting the 21st century tunnel diggers. The pits were detected in 2015 by a high-tech remote sensing survey of 3,000 acres of the Stonehenge landscape that received dozens of unexpected monuments. We noticed that these strange anomalies at the time were too busy with everything else to follow up, says Gaffney, who co-led the survey. Later, when we went back, we saw we had these huge pits forming a giant arc around the henge. It was a scale nobody had ever seen before. It was so huge and unexpected that when the team announced their find in 2020, their claims were met with widespread skepticism, and the house-sized pits were dismissed as naturally occurring sinkholes. Additional research, however, proved the rings of pits had indeed been dug by people toward the end of the great Neolithic building boom, adding yet another layer of mystery to the era. The tunnel proposal has divided archaeologists, with some seeing it as a workable compromise for solving the traffic bottleneck. Sooner or later, something is going to have to be done, says archaeologist Mike Pitts, editor of British Archaeology. The fear is they'll take the easy way and widen the existing highway to four lanes, and that is something nobody wants. As for the curators of Stonehenge, the Durrington Pits, and the countless other monuments, one can't help but think they would love the tunnel idea, given the havoc they wreaked on their surroundings by their building bench. Britain's ancient forest bore the brunt of it, not only in the thousands of oak trees, huge oak trees, as a matter of fact, that were felled to build these enormous palisades, but also in the thousands more needed to erect Stonehenge and other megaliths. People don't realize the vast amount of timber that would have been required, Pitt says. In the case of Stonehenge, transporting dozens of huge sarsen blocks, weighing an average of 20 tons each for 15 miles, then erecting them on site would have required great wooden sledges, an enormous amount of scaffolding, and possibly miles of wooden tracks over which the heavily burdened sledges could be dragged. Contrary to popular myth, the one method they didn't use was rollers. Rollers just don't work, says Pitt, citing evidence from many experiments. They jam up constantly. Whatever the means of transport, movement of the massive stones across the landscape likely attracted crowds of festive onlookers. It would have been like watching the space shuttle go by, Pitt says. As impressive as Stonehenge is, you need to drive another 20 miles to the north of the megahenge at Avebury to grasp the sheer scale and diversity of the building boom. While Stonehenge has global name recognition and those famous sarsen trilithons, Avebury, as the 17th century antiquarian John Aubrey put it, does so much exceed its greatness, the so-known or so-renowned Stonehenge, as a cathedral doeth a parish church. The Avebury Henge is almost a mile in circumference, so large that nearly its entire namesake village, including a pub, thatched cottages, and pastures dotted with sheep, fits comfortably into its embrace. The stone circle within it, at more than 1,000 feet in diameter, is the largest in the world. Two more circles lie inside that, and a grand avenue of standing stones leads away from it, stretching a mile and a half across the countryside to an outlying stone and timber circle. And for good measure, the entire eerie mass of Silbury Hill, composed of 500,000 tons of soil and the largest human-made mound in prehistoric Europe, is only a 20-minute walk away. Hidden beneath this sleepy patch of bottomland along the River Kennet, just a mile or so downstream from Avebury, lies what Josh Pollard, a professor of archaeology at the University of Southampton, refers to as the sleeping giants of the Avebury landscape. And he goes on to point out that it's a series of wooden palisades that were built from the trunks of more than 4,000 ancient oaks during excavations last summer. Pollard and his team discovered yet another timber enclosure some 300 feet in diameter, and within it the footings of an enormous rectangular great house more than 100 feet long, with walls made of gigantic timbers towering as much as 40 feet above the ground. This would have been a truly astonishing sight, Pollard says. Yet for all of Avebury's grandeur, and that of other monuments nearby. It's the River Kennet flowing through the sleepy Wiltshire countryside a few hundred yards away that Pollard believes to be the key to understanding the minds of the Neolithic people who built all these things. I think the river was more important to them than the monuments they built along it, he says. You can see it in the creation of Silbury at its source and in the river's relationship to the Palisades. It's a connecting role with the monuments here, just as the River Avon does with the monuments in the Stonehenge landscape. By the dawn of the 25th century B.C., the people of Britain surely must have been aware of the momentous technological changes unfolding on the continent with the development of metalworking. In fact, they already may have been using copper tools acquired by trade. It's hard to imagine something like Avebury Palisades being made without copper tools, says Pollard, adding that any such tools would almost certainly have been reused and recycled many times over during the centuries that followed, making it unlikely that any will ever be unearthed at Neolithic building sites. What sparked the extraordinary building boom and how and why it came to an end remain unsolved mysteries. But archaeologists note an intriguing connection in time with the rise of the Bronze Age, which arrived in Britain by way of another mass migration from the continent. The dates are awfully close, says English Heritage Susan Greeney. Was this splurge in monument building a reaction to the changes that they knew were coming? Did they sense this was the end of an era? Or could it have been the monument building itself that caused a collapse in the society or its belief system that left a vacuum that others came to fill? Was there some kind of rebellion against an authority that was ordering all this unsustainable construction? A more chilling possibility is that a pandemic may have played a role. Scientists have found plague bacillus in a Neolithic tomb in Sweden, and earlier this year it was identified in a Bronze Age grave in Somerset. The ancient variety doesn't appear to be as virulent as the ones that swept Europe in the 14th century, but there's no telling what its effect might have been on Britain's Neolithic people. It could be that, unbeknownst to them, the diaspora who were on the move at the dawn of the Bronze Age were spreading an epidemic, wiping out populations and opening up new eras or areas for people to move into, says the University of York's Jim Leary. One way or another, within a century of Stonehenge's completion, waves of genetically distinct settlers once again were coming over from the continent. History was repeating itself 100 generations later, except this time, the newcomers' ancestry stretched back thousands of years to the Eurasian steppes or steppes inside of Anatolia. The so-called Beaker people brought new beliefs, new ideas, their distinctive beaker-shaped pottery, and meteorological skills that would have defined the coming age. The Neolithic farmers who built Stonehenge and scores of other monuments faded into history, their DNA all but vanishing from Britain's gene pool. The landscape around Stonehenge's would continue to be an important burial site, but the era of mega-monuments was over. Monument building is usually a kind of peak of civilization, Larry says, but I don't think this was the peak of a civilization. I think it was a mad, manic final throw of the dice of a society that knows its time is up. What a fascinating story, and there's so many photographs here. We just don't have time to go over all of them, but I will share a couple of them. In the West Kennet Palisades, one of the grandest monuments that arose during the building boom was a series of huge wooden enclosures today known as the West Kennet Palisades, about 20 miles from Stonehenge, on the River Kennet, and it's one of the 4,000 massive oak timbers. Contains a dark stripe in the earth where a wood pillar rotted away thousands of years ago. So that's kind of the things they're learning as they keep on digging and learning more. Well, we've run out of time for today's Armchair Traveler. Thank you for listening. Hope you've enjoyed your journey and that you'll join us again next week. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and I remind you the content of the program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. Questions and comments may be directed to 919-832-5138. The number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.